This morning is a little more formal than you've seen before. It's a more traditional way of opening a lecture. And I thought for our session, it'd be something to try out. So we've been talking. Let me have a sip of water first. Or to be honest, I've been talking about the case number 83 in the Book of Serenity, Dao Wu Tends the Sick. And the opening of that case is Guishan asked Dao Wu, "Where are you coming from?" And Dao Wu says, "I've been coming from tending the sick." So my feeling is, right there at the outset, we know we're dealing with a person of the way. We're dealing with a person who knows what his business is. As the case says, it's all tending to the sick. It's all tending to the sick. Our practice is all tending to the sick. It's all tending to those four delusive minds, four delusive ideas that we have about the self. You remember? Self-view, self-delusion, self-pride, and self-love. So this is a subject for our practice. This is a focus. This is the subject. We are the subject. You are the subject. I am the subject of this investigation. And we undertake this investigation because we've already had an insight. We already know about this sickness, and that's the reason why you're all here, because you already know about this sickness, and that's why you came in the first place. You knew about this sickness and you thought, what can I do about this? Is there something I can do about this? Alienation, feeling of separation, feeling of disconnection from others. Is there something I can do? Is there some treatment plan available for this? And you stayed, for however long you stayed, because you think, yes, there is a treatment plan. I think there is, and I think it's working. You know, it's a little, probably a little slow for everybody. It's a little slow for me. I wish it would work faster. Apparently, I haven't worked on this in other lifetimes. I don't know, but it doesn't seem so. But now, we are applying the treatment, and I would say, lucky us, very lucky to be finding the way, undertaking this course of therapy. So this case, is full of references to, medical model of treatment and that sort of thing. It's got all kinds of references to great physician and so forth. There's the introduction to the case. starts that theme right off. It says, the whole body being sickness. Vimalakirti is hard to cure. The grass being usable as medicine. Manjushri uses it well. How can that compare to calling on a transcendent person gaining peace and gaining peace and well-being? So you know the reference there at the beginning is to the Vimalakirti Sutra, which note to self and others, we should read in our study group. It'd be a very good thing to put on our list for the for future study. Just read the Vimalakirti Sutra. No commentary, just read it. And we can talk about it too. We can provide the commentary. I would like to do that at some time. Vimalakirti was sick and anyway. I won't go into that. Would take me off on a tangent. I will not go there. The case is has a lot of reference to treatment and medical models. And I was thinking, you know, that the root of medicine is medical research, right? You have to really, you know, to be able to apply a treatment, we really have to do some deep investigation. And in these days, we're very grateful, like on the conventional level of the world, which is so relevant to us today and why we're all wearing masks and so forth. We're very grateful, that there is medical research and that there are some scientists who can look deeply into the structure with their electron microscopes. They can look deeply into the structure of the molecule of the virus, the coronavirus. And with that deep investigation, minute investigation, they can find out where the weak links are in that, where that virus is vulnerable, where it can be, you know, attacked and rendered neutral. And when they find that place, they can develop a vaccine, which they have done, to neutralize that virus, render it ineffective. You can come in contact with it and not get sick, or only get mildly sick. So we're very lucky, you know, that there are people that have that knowledge and that skill. And, if we consider ourselves as researchers, investigators, we can be like those people too. And I would propose that we are like that. Our subject of study is a little different, but we're doing a very deep, minute investigation of consciousness, of, you know, this basic awareness that we have, and what's going on, and what's arising, and but you know, our goal is a little different. You know, we're not actually trying to investigate, you know, how consciousness is vulnerable. We're not trying to neutralize consciousness, right? We're not trying to, you know. And we do, in a sense, dampen down certain kinds of consciousness. That's true. But we do that in the interests of sort of clearing away the noise in order to see more deeply. So we clear, you know, we clear, you know, our investigation includes, you know, dropping away thinking. And of course, according to Dogen, dropping entirely body and mind, but in the service of seeing deeply, of seeing even more deeply than body and mind, where could that be? In service, though, of not, you know, rendering ineffective, but rendering effective and collected and whole and connected. So it's a whole different study or orientation. We're not trying to kill, we're trying to bring to life. And that's what this story is about. This story of Guishan and Dao Wu, it's about bringing yourself to life. And I think we all feel that this week, sitting, you know, so many hours, we feel ourselves meeting our life differently and meeting others differently, don't we? Hasn't that been observed? A little bit more relaxed, a little bit more not so self-conscious, a little more willing to be yourself just as you are and just let it hang out there, just you, as flawed as you are, just being yourself with other people, with yourself, a little bit of laughing at yourself, a little more lightness, as Roland likes to talk about. So I want to talk about the treatment. This is the Book of Serenity, by the way. It's a very heavy tome. And I want to talk about the treatment that's recommended in this case, the specific treatment. I would propose that the treatment that's recommended in this case is called the treatment of the middle way. The treatment that goes beyond sickness and not sickness, goes beyond existence and non-existence, goes beyond all supposed dualities. And what's pretty amazing to me is that in the very first chapter of Suzuki Roshi's Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, he addresses this aspect of the teaching. He addresses this aspect that we should pay attention to, the problem of existence and non-existence. The very first chapter on posture. He says a few words in I think the opening paragraph about, you know, sitting upright, and then he says this: after some years, we will die. If we just think that is the end of our life, this will be the wrong understanding. But on the other hand, if we think we do not die, this is also wrong. We die and we do not die. This is the right understanding. Some people may say that our mind or soul exists forever, and it is only our physical body that dies. But this is not exactly right, because mind and body have their end. But at the same time, it is also true that they exist eternally. And even though we say mind and body, they are actually two sides of one coin. This is the right understanding. So when we take this posture, it symbolizes this truth. So he pivots back to posture. But this is what he says, you know, right at the outset of his teaching. Here's the fundamental issue, people. You have a finite life. What are you going to do about it? How are you going to live knowing that you're going to die? What's the right way to live that includes non-existence? That doesn't just say, well, yes, yeah, someday I'll die. You know, this is a normal way of thinking, right? Well, yes, someday, far in the future, I won't be here anymore. But do we live with that awareness every day? And this morning when I was thinking about this talk, I thought, Don Juan. Do you know Don Juan, the teaching of Carlos Castaneda? This goes back some years, okay? But Don Juan said, you should live like death is riding on your left shoulder. He said, actually, he didn't say it that way. He said, death is riding on your left shoulder. I just recalled this out of like a million years ago, right? This morning. He said, death is riding on your left shoulder. It's interesting. We put the okay so. Oops, sorry. We put the okay so. We put the okay so over our left shoulder. Nope, that wasn't going to be right. Okay. So I don't know if that has anything to do with it, but you know, Don Juan, that, you know, who was I don't remember the tribal names. Anybody remember his tribal name? Yaki? Yeah, Yaki. Yeah. Everybody's now dredging up their memory. When did I read Don Juan or those teachings long ago? He was a shaman, and this is one of the things that he had to say. Live as if death is riding on your left shoulder. And I would say that's what's being recommended in this case. The middle lines, the middle lines of Hongzhi's poem. Every case has a poem that goes with it. Listen to the middle lines. As though existent, he's basically not non-existent. Utterly empty, he is basically not existent. Not perishing, yet born. Alive, without dying. Those are the middle lines. And I think what's being recommended here and in a lot of, and in the Heart Sutra, is, and a lot of Mahayana teaching, is that we are to, you know, we are to consider that existence and non-existence, form and emptiness, are like a weaving, like the warp and the weave that makes up a whole fabric, the whole piece of cloth. And We are to study our life based on that understanding of the intimate relationship of form and emptiness, existence and non-existence, life and death. And if we undertake to live with that kind of awareness, because it's an awareness, you have to actually, you know, you have to bring this into awareness. It's not something that I think we're rather natively disposed not to bring this into awareness. We're more natively exposed to think, well, this is life and I'm living it, and yay. Let me make the most of it and earn a lot of money and, be a success and you know, have everything I want and, make sure I, everybody I know is okay and, well, those other people just have to get along with that, you know, on their own. So, you know, if we fall into, so what I think the perspective that is really being talked about here is not falling into existence and not falling into non-existence. Okay, that's, I think, what's really being brought out. So that's why Suzuki Roshi can say, you know, this posture, he says, this posture symbolizes, or something like that, symbolizes this truth, right? So as my teacher would say, you know, not leaning into existence, not leaning into non-existence. If we lean too much into existence, it's like, you know, like the life I was just describing, you know, sort of just for myself, getting what I want, having as many pleasures as I can have, rather hedonistic approach to life. So that's one, that's one extreme to be, you know, is the word sybaritic? Is that the word? To be sybaritic? I don't even know, because I couldn't, if you asked me to define it, I couldn't, but it just means to be like living for yourself or living for pleasure, hedonistic, like that kind of approach to life. And there is another approach, which is the approach of non-existence, which is, you know, probably even more dreadful, you know, than less common, but certainly more dreadful. And you know, that's a life of disconnection, alienation, not having a sangha. Well, anyway, not having a community, you know, of people, it can be expressed and has been expressed, you know, in various religious traditions, including ours, of, you know, people that, you know, think that the right approach to practice is to just go off on their own and, you know, face the wall for ever and not relate to anybody and get enlightened on their own without regard for the welfare of other people. So, you know, that's kind of where you can go if you get too much into the emptiness side of practice. So, you know, I don't want to point any fingers or anything like that, but because it's not really, the teaching isn't really about don't do this and don't do that. It's like practice the middle way. That's the teaching. Practice the middle way. Beyond. It's tempting to say between, but it's more like beyond existence and non-existence. And I really think we can practice like this if we remember that death's riding on our left shoulder. You know, that's one thing we can remember. How are we going to live with death riding on our one left shoulder. Let's see. Oh, I just thought I'd read the whole poem of the case. Hongzhi says, when has the wonderful medicine ever passed his mouth? You could say he's referring here to either Dao Wu or Guishan. He's referring to that transcendent person at peace. That's who he's referring to. When has the wonderful medicine ever passed his mouth? Even the miraculous physician can't hold his wrist. As though existent, he is basically not non-existent. Utterly empty, he is basically not existent. Not perishing, yet born. Alive while dying. Alive without dying. Completely transcending before prehistoric Buddhas. Walking alone after the empty eon. Subsisting peacefully, sky covers, earth supports. Moving on, the sun flies, the moon runs. I love this poem. It takes a while to, you know, let it sink in. It just keeps sinking in, you know. It just keeps sinking in. But it's this part, you know, as though existent, he's basically not non-existent. Utterly empty, he's basically not existent. Not perishing, yet born. Alive without dying. It's like you lose track, right? You can't follow it. And that's like, you really can't see the warp and weave in a fine piece of cloth, can you? You can't see that, but you know it's there. You know it's there. And that's how this is. It's the warp and weave of a fine piece of cloth. Existence and non-existence, completely intertwined. So I've said enough. How about you? You don't have to say something about this case. You can say, "How's your week? How's your week been?" Yeah, Kenny.
Well, maybe I don't understand self-love. It's like, oh, I need to work on self-love, so I don't see it that being necessarily a bad thing for me. I was thinking about, I don't know, something that we're already enlightened, that maybe we just have to uncover it. So I don't know, that just was coming to me when I was meditating. I had this Mary Poppins expression, like practically perfect in every way, came into my head, and I thought, yeah, I'm practically perfect in every way. I'm just going to go with that idea and see what comes and goes. And then while I'm this morning, I had this phrase, the myth of Sisyphus came into my head. And I'm like, what? I have no idea. What does this mean? And then I started thinking about healing and how Sisyphus is a person. I'm on a tangent. He needs to be healed. That's kind of like my life sometimes. It's meaningless doing stuff, just pushing a rock. And what would, you know, we do to help Sisyphus, you know, in each moment? Just in a way, I was kind of like sitting. Here I am breathing. It's like pushing a rock. But so that's where I'm at. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, you know what Camus said, right?
No, I remember the title, but I've never read it.
He says, we at the end, he says, We must imagine Sisyphus as happy.
Okay.
So, you know, it's okay. Just pushing the rock, you know. It's like, but you know, as far as the the self-love, the sense here is self-cherishing or self, you know, putting the self in front of others, not your own self-regard. I encourage everyone to have positive self-regard and work on that. Self-respect is so important. Everybody should have that kind of approach to themselves. But the idea here of self-love is, you know, I'm more lovable than the next guy. You know, I deserve more. I'm the most lovable person there is. And I don't think you have that problem. And I don't have that problem. So I think it's working on the, as you say, working on, what was the Mary Poppins?
Practically perfect in every way.
Practically perfect in every way. Practically perfect in every way. I don't know how the tune goes. But yeah, Dave.
Well, Suzuki Roshi said
somewhere in that book, something to the effect of, "You're absolutely perfect. You just need a little work."
Yeah, well, that's a famous thing he said. I don't think it's in Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, but yeah.
Okay.
I was gonna
kind of getting back to caring for the sick, and that's kind of why we're doing what we're doing. And I've just had a dilemma lately with a family member who lost her spouse, who was close to all of us. She has always seemed to us to have kind of slight mental health issues anyway. Not that I'm unqualified to diagnose, but someone who seemed very needy and prone to depression, and who could be kind of demanding just in her personality, and is kind of like, okay, trying to help and trying to figure out what's grief, what's a mental health issue, and what is just personality of this person, and how to help with all these things. And this week of sitting has not provided the answer.
Hmm. Is it possible to just be with this person without trying to figure anything out?
I would say anything's possible, but she is so demanding that she doesn't allow distance, to draw back and try to keep, you know, it's just been perplexing. I'm not really looking for answers. It just kind of came to mind with the from the talk.
Right. Well, you know, Dogen does say there are people who are in delusion throughout delusion, and this is true. And the limit of, you know, we have limits of what we can do for anybody, and sometimes this is, you know, it's kind of part of our suffering that's true, but sometimes that is true. I hear you.
Yeah. From this side of the room.
Oh, there's another microphone. Oh.
Yeah, there is. How did that happen? You know, Dave, just to quickly comment on your point, I was just reading an article by Norman Fisher on exactly that point. I think it was entitled "How to Deal, How Do We Work with a Difficult Person?" And his bottom line was understanding that they're conditioned people. And with that, and understanding that we're conditioned people, and then maybe just having a little more compassion with that realization. That's how he ended up, I think, in that. So, but what I appreciated your talk, Jim, and even the subject matter, because I've been working around in my mind for quite a while this idea of approach life as if death is imminent. Or Suzuki Roshi says, I think we must die to practice. Or there's a lot of these sayings in our tradition. And I've never really come to try to figure what the heck is being said here. But just the other day I had some kind of a little mini realization, which a year from now may turn out not to have been any realization at all, who knows. But as of right now, it occurred to me that maybe they're not talking about death, you know, physical death. I mean, there's a lot of ways to say, well, if I know I was going to die in a week, how would I live? And some people would be the ones that go out and do everything they can, you know, and get and have thrills and what. But maybe what he's talking about is we must die in order to live. We must die. Is the fact that each moment we let go. We let go of ourselves. We let go of our thoughts. We let go of everything. And that's the dying. The dying, the letting go of our small self, the ego-driven self, the self that thinks it's separate from others. That's the death of the self, it seems to me right now. It makes more sense to me if you think of it in that manner. What is the great matter of life and death? So, can
the
we
death, live? The death of that person and the birth of the true man at peace, or the true person at peace.
Exactly.
Thank you. Now, Cody.
I really enjoyed your talk today. A lot of the different points and the point that really my mind just wanted to latch onto that and run with it and was the fabric of existence and non-existence, I think we naturally conceive of non-existence as something separate temporally, in terms of I'm existing right now. When I lay my head down and go to bed, I seemingly non-exist for a little while and then wake back up and I'm existing. And when I hit the pillow for that final slumber, I'm entering into non-existence. But if I think what you're proposing, what Suzuki was proposing, is that if we take the stance of there only being one reality, then they are both at the same time within our experience, within our life. I think, like you said, you know, and when we sit, we pay attention to our posture, our breath, sensations, thoughts. It's as if things that we think are existing are dissolving into what seems like non-existence, and that borderline between what is actually existing. You know, I have this concept of people and sensations and all these things seemingly existing, but when you look, like you said, when you put that microscope on it, all of a sudden what we conceive of as existing is not so clear. And like when you said, when we take awareness as our fundamental basis of what or who we are, which is a non-objective experience, then non-existence doesn't seem to be so estranged from us either. I know that's getting quite metaphysical, but I really like that point because it brings, like you said, it brings death, not something that is so far distant in the future, right on your shoulder of, it's with me right now. You know, that thing that we try and run away from of, there will be a time in the future, but it's also present right now.
Thank you. Yeah, in response to your comments, I think that we do have to acknowledge that, you know, our electron microscope, you know, we don't have actually the most powerful. We don't have the electron microscope of a Buddha. I think only a Buddha, you know, because they say, you know, only a Buddha can penetrate cause and effect, and I would say probably only a Buddha can thoroughly penetrate existence and non-existence. So there is some part of this is that's just murky, right? We can't really, for instance, you can try this. You can try. People do this. I'm going to go to sleep, but I'm not going to lose self-awareness. You can try that, and I've tried that, and it's never happened. And I don't know that I've ever had a dream that I've not been fooled by. So, you know, there are limits to our electron microscope. Isn't perfectly powerful. But nevertheless, I think we can hear these teachings, and this is where faith arises, right? It has to be true. It has to be true, because it's just too improbable that existence and non-existence have nothing to do with each other. It's just improbable. And so just as I was saying, just as I cannot see the warp and woof of this fine cloth that makes up my robe, I know it has to be there. It has to be there for this robe to be here. So I have faith. I have faith in my robe.
Jim, thank you for your talk, and thank you to everyone for your practice this week. It's been a wonderful week. Today I have death on my left shoulder because I had a very beneficial sit yesterday, but very difficult dreams last night as well. And I encountered a friend of mine who passed away in one of my dreams. And so this morning I've been sitting with a number of people who I've lost, but able to sit, and I don't really have a comment on it. I don't know where they've gone, and I less and less I seem to not know where I've come from or where I'm going, but it is It's very good to be able to sit. In the pain and the appreciation in everything. And on a lighter note, and also because I just would like to laugh, after our last sit last night, I went to go brush my teeth and looked in the mirror and thought, wow, you look great. So now I have to get rid of all the mirrors in my house. So thanks, Jim.
Thank you.
Well, it's so wonderful to be here with everybody in person. It's really a gift. I just wanted to share something that feels like it's kind of a fruit of this session for me. And last night, I wasn't with you all, and I had made this choice because one of my daughters, who has three very young children, is going through a very difficult divorce. And so there was a lot of need for us to be with the children. And then my other daughter and her wife and their child, we were all together. And at first, it was like really hard. I mean, they were fighting with each other, and one, you know, was trying not to go to the bathroom and poop in his pants, and, you know, they were talking over each other, and I was like, oh my gosh, this is incredible. And, but I don't know, I could stay sort of calm and moving around, and I began to notice that there were four adults, I mean, we're all children too, but four adults, and four children, and there was like this dance, like all four adults, we were like moving in some kind of harmony between these different children, offering something. And this went on for maybe about an hour. And I didn't really realize all of this until later, but it was like things started to happen. The children started to calm down. You know, people were playing with each other in a good way. And I calmed down. And, you know, I woke up this morning and the thought, I read Anderson always says this, Buddha activity is always trying to happen. And it felt like that was happening, like something was trying to happen. And then, you know, there was enough time so that there was a point at which it felt like everybody was okay. So I'm just very grateful that I could perceive this, I guess, but also that my practice allowed me to just go and move and, you know, attend and not get sort of wrapped up in whatever was getting triggered. So thank you.
And I would submit it was because you were there.
You mean present.
Yeah, you were there.
Exactly.
Yeah, present. You were present for the event. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, really.
And when we're present for the event, we're more likely to see the harmony of the event.
Yeah.
You know? And we see, if we're seeing the harmony of the event, other people start seeing the harmony of the event. Even children, they don't really know, you know? But they're starting to, because of presence,
well,
everyone's
picking it up, even
yeah,
though
exactly.
They don't, you know, think about it, but yeah. It's actually affecting the whole thing.
So instead of a centrifugal force with things flying out from the center, things were centripetal, they were coming, you know, back into the center.
Yeah.
Yeah, wonderful.
Present for it all, yeah. Thank you.
Karen?
Thank you, Dora Lee, for that question, because it's related to the question that I have, or your comment, maybe it was, but and this is kind of off your talk topic, but in the sutra that we read last night, I guess we chanted, it said something that was very confusing to me, which was something like, don't carry with you what you learned on the
sitting.
Cushion.
Don't carry
something.
It around, yeah.
Don't carry it around. Mm-hmm. And I That just seems so contrary to what I have, what I think anyway, learned. So did that, what did you think about that?
I love that line, and I'm very familiar with it. And I think it's like if Dora Lee went to her party and said, you know, I'm at peace here today, folks, and you should get with the program. You know, that would be carrying around what you learned by sitting. To me, that's the kind of thing. That's what I think it means. It's like carrying around your sitting like some kind of badge or representation to the world. Like, I'm a Zen priest, so I'll bow down, you know, something like that, you know. I don't know. It has, to me, a sense of that sense of, you know, the there's an image, you know, in Japan, Hotai, and he well, anyway, I don't know, forget Hotai, but anyway, there's this image of like having an empty bag, you know, like you're not Santa Claus carrying a bunch of, you know, gifts to here for everybody, but you actually appear with an empty bag. And I think that's the sense that I feel from that line. Don't carry around what you learn by sitting. Don't go around waving a banner kind of your practice and enlightenment. Just quietly proceed through your life with your, you know, just your own happiness and your own sense of ease, like, you know, Brendan having that experience, facing difficult stuff, but feeling at ease with it, you know? That's what I heard when you were talking, like thinking of your people that had died and dreaming about people that had died, but yet being at ease. To me, that really spoke to me of, you know, just this quiet, you know, the quiet gift that practice gives.
Thank you, Jim. Yeah, maybe it was the carrying around part that I was missing. There's a difference between maybe being and carrying around something.
Yeah. I mean, we can get tied up in language, right? I mean, language is always, it's like Larry was bringing up being alive, you know, and they're being alive or dead. And there's various ways, you know, these terms are what's called multivalent. You know, they have, depending on the context, they can be, you know, they can mean different things. So we have to, you know, we have to, since we know that Koan Ajo, who wrote that piece, was a man of the way, we have to give him the benefit of the doubt. So if we're giving Koan Ajo the benefit of the doubt, how do we understand that kind of talk? But yeah, there's often times we have to. It's hard because we weren't there when Dao Wu and Guishan were getting together. You know. So maybe I'll mention now, I put a sign-up sheet for practice discussion on the back table if anybody wants to do that this afternoon. And Malia, I'm not picking on you when I say this, but don't sign up for practice instruction if it's a way of running out the clock. But if you have some question that you would, you know, really like to bring, then please do. And it's okay if nobody signs up, that's just fine. I enjoy sitting here in the Zendo with y'all. It's really sweet. So. Thank you. Thank you so much.